Hi, everyone. Welcome to another edition of the Sfarim Chatter podcast. On this episode of the podcast, I'm going to be joined by Rabbi Yaakov Yosef Reiman, also known as Avner Gold, for his Strasbourg Saga series. And we'll be talking, especially as it relates to Shabtai Tzvi, his book The Imposter, The Purple Ring, and others, and as a kind of a postscript to the Shabtai Tzvi series. So also, Rabbi Yaakov Yosef wrote some other Sfarim, Shofar Deshibuda, Shofar Deshtara, as well as he has now an ongoing video, I think, Chumash Shir series, and as well as just published a brand new book, Sefer, called Guide to the Guide. So mazel tov on that, Rabbi Yaakov Yosef, and thank you for joining me.
Thank you very much. The Guide to the Guide is, it's a kitzur of the Moreh Nevuchim of the Rambam, and just speak about it for a minute, that I've tried many times over the years to learn Moreh Nevuchim. It's extremely difficult sefer. It's like I gave up, and I've heard many people say the same thing. They've tried, they've given up. Over the last 6 years, I learned, actually 5 years, I finished it about a year ago. I learned it for 5 years with Chavrusa, Be'iyun. And what I did was a summary, in my own words, in modern readable English, of every single chapter. It's like 170 chapters. And basically, this is a gateway to the Sefer. People can read this book, and they will know what the Rambam is talking about, the basic concepts that he presents. And if some chapter really captures their interest, they can go back to a translation. This is not a translation. This is a summary. It's available on Amazon. It's called A Guide to the Guide. And if you search for A Guide to the Guide, Reiman, you'll find it. And that's it.
Okay, so it's very interesting. I'll put a link in the show's notes, and perhaps we'll do a podcast episode in the future. We'll see about that. So let's start off. I'm sure a lot of listeners are familiar with your books. They grew up with them. I know I grew up with them. Now there's new expanded editions published by Art Scroll. So let's talk a little bit. First, tell the listeners, but like I said, the listeners may know you as Avner Gold, as your pseudonym, but tell the listeners a little bit about yourself personally and your background.
Okay. So I went to Yeshiva in Chaim Berlin many years ago. I learned by Rav Hutner. I learned by Rav Yaakov Moshe Shurkin. I was zeichet to be there for the last year of his life. And I learned by him, and it really changed my life. And it opened me up to the world of Lomdus. And I was there in Chaim Berlin for 4 years. And then I came to Lakewood. And I've been in Lakewood ever since. I keep getting left back every year. I still go to the, BMG every day. And I learn there in the morning, and then I go to Kol Aryeh to write. And I learned in the Kachem Chabura. This Kachem Chabura was considered by many people to be the high point of Lakewood. This was going back over 50 years. It was in the front left corner of Bis Medrash. All the best Bachrim and Yeshiva were learning there. Yerucha Molshe and Chaim Ginsberg and Nissen Goodman and Yaakov Bussell. Shia Hirschberg and Heshbash, and Yaakov Fenstein was really tops. And Rav Schneier, felt that we had actually sucked all the quality out of the Bis Medrash, and the rest of the Bis Medrash was dry. So we were learning, Tumura. This goes back, a lot of years. So we were learning Tumura about 50 years. So we were learning Tumura, so the yeshiva was learning Ksubas. So he asked the Kachem Chabura to learn, together with the yeshiva, Second Seder. So Second Seder, we were learning the Sugi of Shtaris in Ksubas, Nafiut Ches. So that's what we did. And I loved it, and most of the Olam did not like it. It was too much. So towards the end of his month, they went back to Kol HaSurim and Tumura, the last Perek. And I just loved it. And it was very complicated and beautiful. And so then I decided, and I had a lot of Torah there, And about 10 years later, I decided that I'm going to write a sefer on shtaris. So I figured that I have accumulated Torah. I had close to 100 pages of Torah. And I figured, okay, so I'll sit down, I'll work on it, and I'll add some more Torah, and I'll have a sefer. So I went to learn the sugyas, and I think that the Rabbeinu Shlomo gives a person a certain halama. When they undertake a tremendous project, they think that, they'll do it. The person opens a business. Okay, I'll open a business. I rent a place. I make a store, all this, that. But once you get into it, it's overwhelming. But at the time when you decide to do it, you don't realize how overwhelming it's going to be. But then it's too late. If you have a little bit of character, you just go through it. And that's what happened with Shtoris. And I learned it for two and a half years, and I hardly used any of my original Torah. And I wrote a sefer, and it was, I went to Rav Shach, I got a beautiful, beautiful askoma, and it became a famous sefer. And during this time, you know, I was already in my early 30s, and I needed parnasa, you know. So we had a company called CIS. We started it then. And the idea, CIS stood for Creative Institutional Services. And what our plan was, I had also done a translation of Menorah Samar. And the plan was to give excerpts of the Menorah Samar to Meisters, to actually Mifal Torah V'Das. And they sent it out in the mail. It's not so popular these days, but in those days, in the 80s, they did a lot of fundraising by sending out books. So they sent it out, and they were successful with it. And then Beis Kela of Lakewood, the high school of Lakewood, Rabbi Shenkelevsky, so they wanted to do a mailing. So they asked us to put together stories. Okay, so I said, okay, we'll get some stories. And we were not successful. The stories came in, they weren't good. We got somebody to write them. They weren't good enough, and, you know, and it was getting late. And we were coming to the deadline. And Rabbi Shenkelevsky asked me I should write something. You know, somehow he knew that I could write. I don't know why. I mean, I could write a sefer, doesn't mean I could write stories, but he asked me to do it. So I said, okay, I had no choice. And I locked myself in a room for 5 days, and I wrote the first Promised Child in 5 days. It's much smaller than today's Promised Child, but it was a book. And people ask me always where I came up with the name Avnagold. Why Avnagold? And the truth is that there's no real reason for it. I wrote this book, and it was 100 pages, and they printed it up, and he's going to send it out, and it's called The Promised Child, and I needed a name for it, so I figured that I didn't think it would be anything. I thought it was a throwaway. You know, they send it out in the mail, get in, make a few dollars, the thing goes, because it just, you know, it's totally forgotten. So I thought, okay, I like the name Avner. And gold, I think a neighbor's aunt's name was Gold. So fine, Avner Gold. It's the same as anything else, Avner Gold. So that's what I took. Actually, it sounds pretty good. But I didn't plan it, and I didn't figure out that this would be. I don't know if it really sounds good or if it sounds good because we know what it is. But, you know, that's what it was. And the story. And the story was a story that I used to tell my children, a little bit of a story. I guess I figured I'll take that story and I'll build on it. And I sat down in a room for 5 days, and I just wrote it with no outline, just stream of consciousness, making it up as I go along. I did not look at a map. Every city that came to, I made up the name of the city. I just made up the whole thing. I said, okay, fine, it's the story. And then the people liked it. They liked it, and they wanted a sequel. So I thought, okay, a sequel. when did this story take place? I had no idea. I knew it wasn't in modern times. I knew that they didn't have cars, that horses and wagons, but I didn't know if it was the 1400s or the 1800s. I had no idea. I had no idea where I had no idea. So I had to figure out when this story, where to set this story. So there was no historical background in there, nothing. I mean, I didn't even know which century it was in. How could there be historical background in it? But I'm glad you're laughing. It's funny. It is funny. So anyway, so in the story of the Promised Child, there's a fictional rabbinic family called the Pulachevers. They didn't even have a last name. There's a city called Pulachev, which is modeled after the city of Narol, where my grandfather was Rav. There were Rabbanim there for 18 generations. And I knew some things about that city. City was like not much of a city, a couple of hundred families. And I modeled it after that, and just the place in southeastern Poland, in Galicia. And I don't know anything else. So in the story, there's Mendel Pulachever, and he's the Rav of Pulachev. That's why his name is Pulachever, because I didn't bother giving him a name. Today he's called Strasbourg, but then he was Pulachever. And there was a debate in Krakow. And there was, they wanted to expel the Jews of Krakow, and they had to have a whole debate, and a bishop, and a this, and they needed a rabbi to go debate with the bishop. So they invited Rav Mendel Pulachever to debate with this bishop. So I thought to myself, you know, Krakow was a big city. They had big rabbonim, very big rabbonim. So why would they invite Rav Mendel Pulachever from Pulachev to come to Krakow to go to participate in the debate when there were big rabbonim there? So I did some research, and I discovered that in the 1640s, there was a three-year gap between the Bach and the Tosfos Yontif. And therefore, I said, this is where my story took place. It took place during that interregnum between the Bach and the Tosfos Yontif. Now I knew where I was. I was in 1643. Okay, so the second story continues in 1643. Now, the second story, I already did some research. And then I read it afterwards. I read the Promised Child two times, and I would do it a third time. I put a lot of background into it. Jewish history, it was in the middle of the 30 Years' War. I wrote a lot about the 30 Years' War, which was a major, major war in Europe, which most people never heard of. And then I followed that. So I actually stumbled into a very rich period in Jewish history, because this my third book, Year of the Sword, was Tach V'Tat in 1648. And 1649. And then the next book, Twilight, took place right after that. And the following book was The Impostor. Now, when I wrote these books, I did a little bit of informal research in the yeshiva. I took like a kind of a poll. I wanted to know, I didn't know much about this. I really didn't. I was always into history. But exactly like Tach V'Tat, like just knew very vaguely what it was. And there it was right in front of me. So I went around the yeshiva asking people what they know about Tach V'Tat. Most of them never heard of it. And then later with Shabbos Tzvi, I checked. Most people didn't know any idea when Shabbos Tzvi was. Was he in 100 years ago or 1,000 years ago? They didn't know. People didn't know. Anyway, but that's where I was. I was in Shabbos Tzvi, and I had to do the research and had to write about him. And I think like what most people in our community who are not history buffs, what they know about Tach V'Tat and what they know about Shabbos Tzvi is from my books, I really think so, you know.
And so I want to just jump in over here. So I'll let you continue on the story more. And I do think it's true. I mean, I grew up with this, and I think a lot of people still do today, like you're saying. This is still what they know. So a couple of things. First of all, so you were saying when you started writing this, it was more of a book. It wasn't more like you were a historian or, you know, you're a self-taught historian, you're into history. It was more something that you just decided you're going to, like you said, you gave the story and you wrote it and then you did the research after. So it's almost like, sounds like you got into history more after the fact. You started really researching.
Well, I got into research when the series became serious. When the first book, which I thought would be just a throwaway, then I didn't bother with research. But once I realized that it's going to be something, and it ends up being 12 books of, continuing sequels, then I really went into seriously research it.
Right. So you touched on a thing that I think personally, this is a personal opinion, the listeners can agree, disagree, email me. I think historical fiction is something that is a really good tool and a vehicle to teach history, especially to kids or younger people and people, like you say, in our community, because it's a tool, it's a vehicle where it's a novel, it's interesting, it's entertaining, there's a story, but yet there's real history, there's things that people can learn rather than just a dry history book. And by the way, we can even talk about that, even just history books, there's not a lot of history books written properly that are, you know, besides academic history books. So,
I wrote a history book back in the 90s, which is called Destiny. And it's like a first volume, which I never got to the rest of it, but it was extremely, extremely popular. And it was, okay, we could talk about it maybe later.
We'll try to get to it. Yes, I think the question of the historical fiction is, do you think, I'm trying to think how to ask this. So in your book, your historical fiction, first of all, there's historical fiction where people just take characters that live and just totally change and embellish the facts. I mean, your books, obviously they embellish some facts. We can talk about it, like the dragon's teeth when we get to Shabbos Tzvi with Avram Yachini. But in generally, you try to...
I'm very scrupulous with the history. I know like a very famous story is the adopted princess, the Shach's daughter. It's just totally not true. So it's like, I don't know if that's historical fiction or just plain fiction. So I don't play with the facts. You know, I study them, and then I paint the fiction around the history. If I have historical figures that speak, I will have them say things that they might have said, like Gedolim or generals. I will not have them, you know. I'm very careful with what I put into their mouths. Very, very careful.
Yeah, that's something, and that'll get to my point of historical fiction. I was thinking we want to get to the question, but I think something that you write in your books, if you have the Chacham Tzvi, for example, or Rav Shmuel Kaidenover, you have been talking, you put, it's very interesting, you write an introduction, you take a Dvar Torah, something that they said in their Svarim, and that's what you put into their mouth. But on the flip side, I will say even that.
Sometimes, from the fictional characters, I'll take a Dvar Torah from my Svarim and put it into their mouths. And on the bottom, I'll write, this is from Abir Yosef al HaTorah.
But on the flip side, I mean, even that, is that something that you think why there's this lack of historical fiction? Because like you're saying, everybody today basically knows Avner Gold. Obviously, people enjoy the books, but if there'd be more historical fiction, it depends on the quality of the writer, but people probably would enjoy it and learn more, but there isn't. Is that something you think because people are worried to write books in Gedolim, even if you're putting the Torah in their mouth, that they're like, well, now we're suddenly talking about Gedolim and they're nervous about that?
About what? Putting words in their mouths?
No, just to even talk about the Gedolim as a story.
Good morning, how are you? Would you like a coffee? I can't say that. No, they only express opinions that are their opinions. Or they'll say things that are just vanilla. I'll say, you know, you have to be, you know, you have to be sad about the Churban Beis HaMikdash, or things like that. But otherwise, I'm very careful with them. Very careful. Historical fiction is, you know, it's hard. It's very hard to write a song. I grew up on historical fiction. I read The Three Musketeers and The Count of Monte Cristo. Count of Monte Cristo is not that much, not so much. But The Three Musketeers, or 20 years after, The Vicomte de Bragelonne, these books are all about French dynasties and French politics. You know, I read those when I was younger, and I enjoyed them very much. I liked them, and I knew that what is real and what is not. Like Cardinal Richelieu was the prime minister of France by Louis XIV. I knew that. Was D'Artagnan a real person? No. But I saw how it interplayed. You know, I could see that. So maybe that's where I got my introduction to it.
Now, just going over the series in general a little bit more, before we get to the Shabbos Eitz Tzvi, as I said, it's somewhat a postscript of Shabbos Eitz Tzvi, and I think that's a famous story, and like you said, mainly people know about Shabbos Eitz Tzvi from your bunch of books that are, The Imposter is completely dedicated to Shabbos Eitz Tzvi, and I'll make a comment in a minute, I reread it now, but before that, just going on in general on the whole series, so like you said, you mainly goes through, the completely 17th century, it's in its right. entirety, with a little bit in the 16th and a little bit.
Well, the last decade in the 16th and
the beginning of the 18th.
And the first decade of the 18th.
So when you started doing your research, once you started doing research, I mean, what did that entail? What kind of sources were you using over this entire series?
I did a lot of research on European history. I read European textbooks. I read your histories and European history. I felt that I really had to understand the politics of Europe, all the dynamics of the 30 Years' War, and the conflicts of all the empires. And they play a big role in my books, all the politics. So I did a lot of research on that. As far as the Jewish history, it was easier because it was more straightforward. You know, this guy's good and this guy's bad. And this is a Gödel and this is a Russia, you know. but it's not as complex. So the background of like in Murano Prince, there's so much complexity of European history and the interaction of Spain and the Netherlands and France, England. And it plays a big role in the book.
Right, now the classic Jewish history, like when you did Tachvatat, was that classic, you know, Yavi Mitzula. I mean, and when you got into, I mean, certain things, and I guess when you're talking about Sfarim, like Chacham Tzvi, you have Tshuvas Chacham Tzvi to read or whatever. You read Chronicles and actual Sfarim, is that how you did a lot of the Jewish history? Or Tzitzis Nevel Tzvi on Chapsi Tzvi?
Well, my basic source for Jewish history of the whole time was Toldos Am Yisrael from Yavetz, Zev Yavetz. Now it's a 14-volume And it's really pretty comprehensive. And that was, I think, my, you know, just to give you the bare bones of what was going on, that was my main source. And then, you know, every era had different sources. Chacham Tzvi was, you know, his forum. Chacham Tzvi was the Megillah Sefer from Yankov Emden. It was a very rich source for what went on. Shabbos Eitz Tzvi, like you said, the standard sources. I use Gershon Scholem, of course. Gershon Scholem is, you know, not exactly from our cheder, but you know, he has many opinions, and I really didn't subscribe to his opinions. But he did serious research, and he has letters that people wrote, and he has facts. I don't think he falsified the facts. I don't think he falsified them. So I want to know who did what and when and what was that. Gershon Scholem is a very good resource. When he has his opinions, you know, these type of that school of historians, including Gretz, and I can say that I may have glanced into Gretz too, but they, to them, Lurianic Kabbalah is the villain. And that's not what we believe. So they're coming from a totally different perspective. So that whole part of their writings, I completely discount it. I just ignore it.
Because the comment I was going to make is, I reread The Imposter before this podcast. in the expanded edition, and it felt to me that I was reading, obviously broken down and in a novel and in a kids, you know, not kids, but a younger book. But it felt like I was reading Gershom Scholem in a novel, a little Jesus, a little sweet. That's literally what it felt. And I don't mean that in a bad way. I mean, Gershom Scholem with his facts, like you're saying, not his opinions that people argue on in many ways.
Is very rich. Very. I mean, he did a great work as far as research. Excellent. I mean, unless what he writes is falsified, then I don't believe that. I don't believe that.
I mean,
it was a big problem with all the sources that I had, where to create a timeline, what happened when, I had to, the timeline that's in this book is my best guess to what happened when. When did he marry the Tyra? When did he go to Salonika? All these things, everything is in conflict. It's very different at that time. No, you didn't have CNN or the New York Times then. You didn't have our type of journalism. Information in those days came from rumors and letters, private letters that people sent. And that's where you knew things. You didn't have any published, you know, newspapers or chronicles. So everything came afterwards and was based on very unreliable sources.
I want to ask you a little bit particularly about the Shabbos Tzvi book, though, because I said it's a postscript. We just finished this series of Shabbos Tzvi. You mentioned Scholem. Listeners know there's plenty of guests have taken issue with things that Scholem have said. I mean, you can read academic things on Scholem, but just as a whole, I mean, what was your? I also felt so. I read The Purple Ring as well. The Imposter book felt more like more the history than fiction. It was more like a history book,
biographical.
Yeah, more than just...
It was biographical, some flies on the wall.
Yeah, that's a good way of putting it. So is that... I mean, what did you think? I mean, how was that, writing that book versus writing the other ones, like in the research and actually going into it?
Yeah, but, you know, he's a character, you know, very interesting character, just because he was historical. I mean, he was a good, like, fictional type character. But, yeah, I enjoyed writing about it.
You mentioned that you didn't know a lot of people today know about Shabbos Tzvi and Nathan of Gaza and Avram Yachini and all the characters, you know, Sarah Ashkenazi from your book. Is that, do you think that, I'm sorry, did you know when you started writing this, was that something that you knew about or you had to do all this research?
I didn't know the story. I just knew there was a Shabbos Tzvi, Mashiach HaSheker. I didn't know about Nosson Azati, Avraham Yechini, Shmuel Primo. I didn't know about these people.
Yeah, you actually read in the beginning of the book that maybe it's two Shmuel Primos.
Well, there's a Shmuel Primo that's quoted later in the Chidah, and there are some people that say there were two, and some people that say that there was him, and I would like to believe there were two.
Yeah, talked about in previous episodes, especially with that Shmuel Primo went after.
If he really, really did tshuva, then I wouldn't have used his name. There's another big Rav in the book, a very big Rav, who is a pillar of halacha, and he was the Rav of Smyrna. And he went over to him for a few months, and I did not use his name. He just went over to him for, and he got swept up in the madness, and then he was dropped right out of it once he put on his turban, Shabbos Tzvi, and you know, I don't see why I should you know, besmirch his reputation.
Right. I mean, right. The rabbanim that were against him, like his Rebbe Reza Viskapa and Rebbe La Papa, those I think you did include.
Yeah, sure. Bianca Shaspartas is in there. Moshe Chagiz, different people, they're there. But the ones that are against it, that were for him, then I only used the names of those that stayed for him.
So when you did your research, and then you actually wrote the book, so I assume as a novelist, you kind of live with your characters a little bit, even if it's historical fiction. So what was your opinion? What did you think of reading about Shabbos Tzvi and all these, like I said, all the characters in there?
What do you mean, what I thought about them? I thought that was very, very interesting. I mean, Tell me specifically what you want.
I mean, just in general. I mean, it almost feels like a fiction. I mean, if you listen to the whole story, it almost feels now, for us looking back, the whole, there's just still...
You wonder if I felt that it was fiction at the time? No, I felt it was real, and it was like I was trying to keep up with the characters. You know, when I you'll think it's a little bit crazy, but when I do dialogue, so what I do is I create the characters in my mind, and I let them speak. I don't put words in the mouths of the characters. I let them speak, and I'm just typing and trying to keep up with them. And very often they will say things that surprise me. You know, it sounds funny, but it's true. They do. So, you know, these characters, you know, I kind of brought them to life in my mind, and I let them interact and I let them talk. And, you know, it's dramatic. It's very interesting. I'm like, I'm in the story. You know what I mean? I'm just trying to keep up and record what's going on all around me.
Yeah, I mean, that's
like there's this thing with the Shabsai Tzvi and Chamikon at the end, and they're like touching. They're like, and I didn't plan what they say. I didn't plan it. I just let them go, and I knew more or less where each one was going to go. But that was a very intense conversation over there at the end, and I just hung on for dear life.
Yeah, that's kind of more what I meant, you know, just in general. So, I mean, another thing about this really is, I mean, what kind of feedback did you get, especially to this book, kind of something that people maybe didn't know so much about, and you're explaining this whole thing. Did you get, like, a lot of...
You mean flack or feedback?
Both.
Well, I got a little bit of flack from Lubavitcher booksellers, who thought that I was writing... I wrote this in the 80s, and they thought that I meant the Rebbe, and I totally didn't. Had no connection to the Rebbe. And just that's where my series took me. But I think they got over it. But people liked it a lot. They were very... I didn't get the flack. No, I didn't get any flack. No, people liked it. In general, I didn't get flack for the books.
And you mentioned a lot of it, and I'm reading it myself, a lot of it was historically accurate. And even the dragon's teeth, the famous story of Avraham Yechini forging the
manuscript. Yeah, they all ask me that. They all ask me, was the dragon's teeth true? Well, what is true, what is recorded in history, is that Avraham Yechini falsified a document, and it was like an old document, and they found this document, and it predicted that Shabtai Tzvi was Mashiach. But how exactly did he do that? That I made up. They went to this cave, the dragon's teeth. They went down. They went there. He went that. There's no. I made that up.
Right.
The dragon's teeth. They all ask about the dragon's teeth. I guess it was good.
Yeah, and then afterward, now that whole book is dedicated to Shabtai Tzvi. But then you continue in the Purple Ring, and
Purple Ring really talks about the disappointment and the disillusionment and the shame of the Jews of Europe, in the face in front of the Goyim, that the whole thing was a fake, and people felt really hit rock bottom there. And it was after Tachfetat, you know, they thought everything was such a disaster. Now Mashiach comes, and then that's just blown out of the water, and it was a tremendous amount of disillusionment and depression. But the story of Shabtai Tzvi, it went on for 100 years. You know, it wasn't like he converted. I mean, in 1666, he converted to Islam. He died 10 years later. But it was still, in the middle of the 1700s, there were still eruptions of Sabbateanism. Interestingly, the Sabbatean, continuation of Sabbateanism was in Europe. It was not in the Sephardic countries. I don't think they had Sabbateanism. We had, in Europe, we had the Donman, we had this Nechemi Chayun, who was a Sephardi, but it was in Amsterdam. And you had the Frankisten and the Jacob Frank, and there was a lot of, and they originally were afraid that the Hasidim were Sabbateans. So this was 100 years of turmoil. But interestingly enough, in the Sephardic countries where Shabbat Tzvi arose, not really.
Although the Dunmet were in Turkey, Salonika, you did have them.
Turkey, okay. I'm talking about a little bit further south. Syria, Egypt, Morocco, these countries. Not really. Dunmet were in Greece. In Salonika.
It was part of Turkey, but yeah.
Turkish Empire.
Turkish Empire. But tell me, so the Purple Ring, you mentioned something interesting, how you were trying to portray like the psychological effects. So that book is more of a novel that I'm reading that after The Imposter. But something interesting in there is that, like you're saying, that more you portraying the psychological effect that it had in those days. So it's almost, I don't know if that's something you found historically or something that you're envisioning.
No, historically, it's known that there was disillusionment and depression, that's known. But I just tried to create it in stories. The stories that I created, are fictional. No, there's no, they're fictional. But I got to the Midnight Intruders, which is when Nechemi Chayun came to Amsterdam, and there was this raging battle between the Sephardic and the Ashkenazic communities. And the Chaim Tzvi was the leader of the Ashkenazim. And it was just, you would think that if a person is a Sabbatean, that people would shun them. But because of politics, they accepted him. The issue in Amsterdam was, Chaim Tzvi is an Ashkenazic rabbi, and he's going to tell us what to do. And no, the Sephardim will make our own decisions. He says that he's a Sabbatean. So no, we'll accept him. I mean, if he's a Sabbatean, you shouldn't accept him. But people do make tremendous compromises for the sake of politics. A lot of that went on in Europe when there were different pockets of Sabbateans. And there were politics, and people decided to turn a blind eye to them. That's the way it is. It's the way it is today. People turn blind eyes for politics, for power, for money. That's the way it is.
In Amsterdam, you had the Sephardi Jew forever. Rav Shlomo Aiyalon was Sabbatean, so you had a problem
you
there.
You can't compare, okay. No, but he supposedly was a lapsed Sabbatean.
Yeah, I mean, if you listen to the show, Professor Matt Golder spoke about it, though, but he said he officially was, but he said he doesn't. He found that he never was.
I don't know. I have no opinion on him. But certainly he doesn't compare to the Chaim Tzvi. When there's a battle between those two, the Sephardim rallied around him.
And the Mamad, of course.
And they all had tremendous respect for the Chaim Tzvi. The Sephardim had tremendous respect for him. But when it came to, friction between the communities, they rallied, and they were willing to accept Chaim Chayon. It was a shita in Kabbalah, Sabbateanism. It wasn't just a man. It was a shita, and it continued. Rabbi Yankov Emden accused Rabbi Yonis Naibishetz, and he opened up the Kameya. I don't know what was in that Kameya, but I'm assuming it didn't say Hail Shapsai Tzvi. There were certain formulations there which were consistent with Sabbatean Kabbalistic Shitas. You know, the Sabbateanism was Trinitarian almost. They believed that Mashiach was part of the Godhead. You know, things like that. So what kept it going was really the Shita, not just, and that all people were reincarnations of Shabtai Tzvi. This fellow, what was his name?
Well, Frank, for one.
Brachia maybe, Bruchia, right, him. They all claimed that they were reincarnations, but there was more than that. There was like the ideas that this, it freed you from halacha. You know, we had this, you know, Mashiach says when Mashiach comes, then the Torah is suspended. Now, yeah. I mean, all kinds of different things.
Now, when you wrote The Midnight Intruders, was that, did you mainly rely on Rabbi Yaakov Emden, Megillah Sefer, and Rabbi Yaakov Emden? Did you use it all, Professor Leshev Akabach's book? You didn't use that. You know, Mashiach Higgins, you didn't use it.
No. I didn't, you know. I used Yaakov Emden, and I used the, you understand, the Yavetz. I used Yavetz, a couple of other things, but basically that. When it came to the Murano Prince, there I used Netanyahu, Benzion Netanyahu, who's brilliant.
Bibi's father.
Unbelievable. I don't like Bibi, but I love his father. Wasn't from, but he was such a great historian. He has a book which is called History of the Muranos, according to the Hebrew sources. And the whole thing is based on the writings of the Rishonim. And on the bottom, he has the Lashon of the Rishonim in Hebrew. And it's an incredible book. I mean, it's unbelievable. And so that was very, very interesting. Also, I used, you know, the only thing that people had before on, is okay, we're going through Muranos a little bit. Was Marcus Lehman. He wrote a book called The Family E. Aguilar. It's not accurate. You know, when you read that, I have all respect for Marcus Lehman.
Yes.
Yeah, he was a Choshev.
That was a story, he wrote historical fiction. He did similar to what he was doing.
Yeah, but he did. He was, took more liberties with the facts. But listen, I have a lot of respect for him. He wrote Yosselman of Rosheim is really a very, very good book. But and if you read The Family, I don't blame him for this. You get the impression that the Murano kids, they didn't wear their tzitzis out. They tucked them in. This is, you know, that there was like, that's the impression you get. But he wrote this in like the 1850s or something. The Inquisition closed in 1837, and the Inquisition had voluminous records. Every torture scene, there was a transcript of everyone. Every maravedi that they spent on an auto da fe was accounted for. Everything. There was a tremendous amount of information, and none of this was accessible to Marcus Lehman. So he did, you know, he wrote a romantic story, and it was, I don't mean romantic in that sense, but you know, but afterwards, there's a lot of work done. I read this a book by Henry Kamen, who was, I don't remember what it's called, also probably called A History of the Muranos, and, you know, it was doctoral work, and I read Cecil Roth. And, you know, there were a lot of books that I read about them, really, really good books, and did a lot of research. And I read these books and to get an idea of what Murano life was like. Murano kids did not know they were Jewish until they were 19. It was too dangerous to let them know.
Well, also, as they called it down, you know, and we see in more conversos, really.
Conversos.
Murano means like pig. It's not really a good word.
Yeah, well, I'm not so sure. We don't know exactly what it means. But conversos, yeah. Crypto-Jews. So in my book, I have like what people like very much in Murano Prince is the Keepers of the Water. I have like where how he reveals to his children that they're Jewish, and he gives them a whole metaphor about a story about keepers of the water. People like it very much. I think schools teach it separately. They say, where did you get this? I said, I made it up, you know. But I know it's pretty simple. So like these, one of these girls, she was such a fromma Catholic girl, and she was so shocked by the revelation that she's a cursed Jew. Couldn't believe it. You know, and there were other ones who really decided they like it. And there was one torture scene that I have over there I have a fictional character called Mateo Vaz. And there's a torture scene. And the torture scene is, I took it from a record of a torture scene. But that torture scene was on a woman called Elvira something. I don't remember her last name. It wasn't Cecil Roth. So I figured I'll make it into a man being tortured too much. A woman being tortured, not for the sensibilities of our community. But it was all, you know, the information that was available was tremendous.
So what would you say you were and you are trying to accomplish with this series?
These books?
Yeah.
Well, in the beginning, I was trying to satisfy Rabbi Shinkolevsky from Beis Kela and make sure he didn't blow my head off. I would make him miss a deadline on his mailing. But once I started it, there was a lot that I wanted to do. I wanted to teach history. I think it was important to know history. And there's a lot of Torah in here. There's a lot of Hashkofa. I get letters from people that got a letter from a woman in Eretz Yisrael that she wrote in Hebrew, but I don't remember. She says that she likes the books very much because many of the other books are really just the same thing as a Goyish book. And he has a beard and he says, Baruch Hashem. But otherwise, it's no different. And these are really, they're very, very Jewish. They're very, very Jewish. And they, you know, the spirit of the community, the spirit. And there's a lot of, like when there's one place where Alicia Ringel is going to the Queen of Sweden trying to get her involved to stop the expulsion from Vienna. And she asks him about mitzvahs, and he explains what mitzvahs are. I mean, these are very important things. You know, there are, I try to do as much of, without taking away from the fun of the story and the adventure and the violence and, you know, a lot of violence.
No, I think that's true. I think a lot of these books really have what to teach historically. Turbid, as I was mentioning before, you pick up now a quote unquote Jewish novel in the store. Half the time it's just, and we all know the typical stereotypical, you know, Mossad, FBI, KGB, yeah. Putting a tefillin, it's about tshuva. It's nonsense. Yeah. It's just ridiculous. Yeah. And here you're actually learning something,
right?
History wise, really, there's not many other. I don't know, there's a couple of writers that do some historical fiction books.
I'm not familiar.
There's a book I'll mention that I read a few years ago that I liked. I think it's called Journey to End of the Earth, and it was about Menashe ben Israel getting the Jews readmitted to England. That was the same similar to Kufa.
Okay.
It was a very enjoyable, actually. Yeah, there's some.
Yeah, I'm sure.
But there's not enough.
There's enough to write about.
That for sure, but there's not enough books out there about this.
I'm not responsible for that. Anyway.
So, I mean, something that you didn't write about, is that something that you did? The book ends before you mention the Franks and Jacob Frank, but that's not something that
right.
you don't have them. That's the next continuation point in the series.
continuation. Originally, when I started doing these books, and it doesn't take me so long to write these books, I do them like Ben Gavra Le Gavra. You know, I'm writing, I'm working on Sfarim. That's what I do. The reason some people want to know why I use name Avner Gold. Why don't I use my name? And the reason for it was because at that time I had published Shofar Shtara. I published my Sefer, Shofar Shtara, and it was a very well accepted Sefer. It was a big deal. And I didn't think that people would, you know, understand that, you know, you know, I could write the Shofar Shtara and I could also write this. Right now, people know that I'm a little bit of, you know, a little different, so I can do that. But at that time, I thought that, it wouldn't work. So I made a secret out of it. I didn't tell anybody. But people suspected. And my daughter says to me, she was very young, I don't know, is she like early teens? She says, tell me, are you having the gold? Are you having the gold? I won't tell anybody. I won't. Okay, so I said, okay, I am. So, like a week later, everybody knew. but it's okay. It's good. In the New Promised Child, in the preface, the first thing I write was, the first thing I want to tell you is that my name is not Avner Gold. And, I came out of the closet. But it was an open secret.
Yeah, I think that's the story that happened. I think J.K. Rowling was writing under a pseudonym and something like that happened.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's like, tell one person. Forget about it.
Yeah. But this is, Lakewood is, it was like, especially in those days, it was more of a one community. Everybody knew everybody. So.
So, but Frank, is that something you would continue doing?
I told you originally I wanted to write Bring It Up to Today. That was my plan. And I thought maybe I'll write 25, 30 books. Why not? But it's just not feasible. I have too many other things to do. I have a sefer on Breira going to print, Shufra de Breira. I have other Shufras. I have a new Madura of Shufra de Shtara. I'm working right now on Tokfa Koyin of the Shach. For the last 2.5 years, I've been learning it, and I'm writing on every single semen, a major work on the Shach, and that's where I live. That's where I am. I have to finish my history book, Destiny, which I mentioned before, which I think is very important. Many people, Destiny, the book that I wrote, it starts from Avram and it goes till the beginning of the Bayis Sheni. And it goes through the Tkufas HaMikra, the Tanakh. And really, it's a Lomdasha book. A lot of it is my, I have a Sefer Al HaTorah called Abri Yosef Al HaTorah. And a lot of it is, a lot of Destiny is in there. I have Pshat, what was going on, Tkufas HaShoiftim, what was going on, Tkufas HaMalachim, what was, all these things, the patterns of history. I did a lot of work on that. And my plan was to bring it forward also till today. So I have to work on that. That's, I think, very important. I have a book on Amuna called Existence and Memory, which I'm working on, which hopefully will be finished in a couple of months. So to go, I can't do so many of these books. So my plan is to write short stories. That I know you don't like that, but I do. The next Kufa, which could have been a book, will be a story of about 25 pages. And the one after that will be another one. And then I could leapfrog story, the same thing, the same saga, the same family, the same characters, going from generational and to go the same style. And each one will have a story, with a historical background. And I could leapfrog down to today in maybe 2 volumes or maybe 3. And I think that would be fine.
You said, you already said, my opinion. Not to detract from your title. I mean, I think these books are very important, make a huge impact on the readers. I want to say that I think you should write more full books, novels like this. I think a novel, a book, really makes an impact and really teaches people history. And especially, you're in the 1700s, you're up to the 18th century. I mean, that's really an unknown time. There's a lot that goes on there.
A lot.
And there's just a lot of
There's
really,
always a lot.
A lot of Gedolim. There's a lot to talk about.
There's always a lot that goes on. I'm selfish. That my first love, my passion, and my sforim. That's really what I want to do. I have a daf al daf on a very big chelik of Shas. I want to work on that. I want to work on the new madura of my sefer chumash. That's really what I love to do. And this, I love to do this too, but it's my second love. And I guess I'm being selfish. I should be self-sacrificing. You know, I think I'm going to sit down, I'm going to write this novel. It'll take me, you know, it'll take me a couple of months to do it, right? So I'll put all this kayak in, and somebody goes in and buys it and reads it in 2 hours and say, ah, that was great. Where's the next one? You know?
But I would say, but the flip side is that especially if you're putting Torah, you're putting history, so you're teaching generations, you're teaching, you know, otherwise.
You're right. I wouldn't write just empty stories. I wouldn't want to do that. I wouldn't want to. But even so,
I mean, the 18th century, you can write more of Yaakov Emden, there's obviously Rabbi Yonasan Eibshitz. I don't know if you're going to write it at all.
I'm going to.
But you have that. Frank, and Rabbi Chaim Rappaport with a disputation in Lviv. And Lambert talk about Ukraine.
Lviv. I call it Lviv.
Okay, but talk about
The Ukrainians. You know, I don't like Ukrainians.
But you have that, and you have later on, and you have the Pnei Yeshua, you have Chassidim, and the Behuda. There's
Baal
so much
Shem,
over there.
My grandfather, Baal Shem.
No, the Behuda, the Vilna Gaon. It's a packed century.
Yes, it is.
You have El Chida and all his travels. You have a wealth of it. There's just so much there that people don't know about this necessarily.
I don't know about it. You know,
and you have Haskalah.
Yes.
And Mendelssohn shows up there, and
and then you have Napoleon, and the beginning of Napoleon was a tremendous influence in Jewish history.
David Zinsheim is an engineer, which smaller kind of mother.
Napoleon led to the Holocaust. You know, he opened up the ghettos. The Jews came out. They conquered. There was a cultural conquest of German society, and that was what the Holocaust was about. I want to write about the Holocaust because people don't understand what it is.
But here's what I would point out for a second. I'm not saying that. But think about what we're talking about, the 18th century. So many people, you're saying, and so many kids or teens who read the book don't know about this. And here you have the perfect vehicle to teach them about this.
I understand, but why can't I do short stories? Short stories are an art form. They're hard-hitting. A short story...
I don't think it's as impactful. I don't think it resonates. I don't think it sits with.
In a way, it's more, because you get it. You get the whole thing concentrated. It's like short stories are not just short forms of a book. They're like different.
It's different medium. But
they focus on a character, on an event, and the spotlight on that character and on that event is much more powerful in a short story than in a novel. So I cannot be ambitious and try to do like a whole story that would be in a novel, but I could do something very strong in a short story. I look forward to the challenge. You know, it's I haven't done many short stories. I've done a few, but I like the idea of doing that. It's challenging. I'll say like this,
because we're having this conversation, this argument on the podcast. I would say if any listeners have an opinion, send me an email. I don't know if you want to give your email.
Send me the email. Let's see, which email should I give?
You have Avnergold email?
Avnergold is good.
What's the email address?
Avnergold@avnergoldmail@gmail.com.
Okay, people can email you, and they can email me, and I'll pass it along.
I get these emails all the time.
But I think the listeners, if they think you should write more,
they'll bombard me, and I'll give in to the pressure.
Doesn't mean that you will, but if people really think so, I think, you know, and I'm just thinking another, you know, 18th century, the Cleveland Get, the Get of Cleves, ripped apart the whole Europe, such a story of a Get. I mean, such a massive machlek is something that you can teach about. I don't know, just my opinion.
Yeah.
Just my opinion. I mean, so I was going to ask you what goes into writing one of your books, but you kind of answered that. It's a lot of, you know, not the writing, but you're saying more the research. So you have to look into the history, the Torah, and so on.
Yeah, but then I have to, you know, the story. It's all the story. It has to be a great story. That's what makes it. I can't just take the history the life of the book is the story. Each book is like different. You read The Purple Ring,
yes.
Right? The Purple Ring is Agatha Christie. You know, it's like it's like a pure mystery, and at the end, all the characters come together, and Rav Shloime, who is Akul Paro, he does the investigation until he gets the one to admit, you know, by proving, you know, with all the evidence. I thought it was a lot of fun. But it's different, everything. The new Twilight is very different. And the Round Prince is different. And they're all different.
See, Twilight.
They all stand on their own. Even though they're sequels, you could read any of them on its own. But of course, if you read them in sequence, then you really get the full flavor of it.
Let me ask you a question. You said what you're trying to do with them, but what do you think? Let's go back to Shop 6 Feet for a second. What do you think someone can take out of that story? You wrote a book about it. Well, what, is it just like this failed messiah existed, this whole crazy story with all these characters? What do you think?
What it means for us today?
Yes.
I'll tell you what it means for me.
Okay.
I'm vigilant. I see some people, you know, I'm not going to mention who, and I see some people that I think may be, you know, may someday announce that they're Mashiach, and I think they're dangerous, and they have followings, and Shabtai Tzvi was not well. He was not well. He was a manic depressive. He was a genius. But he was, bipolar. That seems to be agreed by the historians, by the Rabbonim, that he was bipolar. So in the end, his illness brought him down because he couldn't control it. But there are people that I see that I think are not bipolar and are smarter and not as flamboyant. But, I don't know, I hope nothing comes of them, but, you know, how it affects their lives? How does anything affect their lives? How does the Machlekes Rav Yaakov Edelman Ben Sinaibish supposed to learn in Musa Haskell that what? You know, what are you supposed to learn? I don't know.
Okay.
But having just understanding the sweep of history gives you, you have to know where you are, where you come from. You have to know, like, it's like a family. If you're in a family and somebody gets married and he joins a family. And then there's a whole family history that he has to learn. Why does he have to learn that history? Why does he have to know it? Because to be part of that family, your wife's family, to be part of that family, you have to know the history. If you don't know about the grandfather that was in Auschwitz and the other grandfather who used to peddle shoes in the pushcart on the east side, and you don't know how they came across and this and that, then you're really not sharing their lives, their experience. So we are the Jewish people. We need to know our history. If we don't know our history, it makes us less connected. You know, we should know the good things and we should know the bad things, but we need to know our history. Otherwise, you know, what are we? We're just like new people that came along, you know, joined the family, don't want to know anything. I think that's important to know it. how much detail do you need? Not that much. You don't need that much. If you're not a scholar or a wonk, then you don't need that much. You just need to know the broad strokes of what happened. You know, there's also, I like to make a certain comment about writing history, that when I wrote Destiny, I'm in the middle of writing it, so I read other books on Jewish history, quite a few. And I think that there are two kinds of histories. There is a history which I call like an endo-history and an exo-history. That means the history is written from the inside and history is written from the outside. Now, an American could decide to write the history of Mexico. He'll do his research, he'll go down there, he'll write the history of Mexico. But if he's not a Mexican, and he doesn't share the geist of Mexico, then he will not have a proper view. Maybe he will have a legitimate view of what Mexico is like from the outside, but he won't know what Mexico is like from the inside. Most of the histories, the non-from histories, that you read about the Jewish people are exo-histories. They're written by Goyim, or they're written by Jews that are not, that are secularized. So even if they have a little bit more Jewishness to them than the Goyim, but they still, you know, they have maybe 1 foot in the house. It's like you have a house, right? So you look into the house and you can see things through the window, but you have people who live in the house and they have a different view of the house. And I think we need to know our history from the inside. And that's really what I'm trying to do. In destiny, that's what I'm trying. There are certain hanochas that we have when we're doing a history from the inside. We accept that the Torah is true. We know that it's true. Now, why? How do we know that? That's a whole different discussion, which we could talk a different time. But that is a premise of our history. So when we look at our history, our history has Yetzias Mitzrayim. It has Matan Torah. It has the Mesorah of the Tanoim and Amoraim. Those are premises of our history. So our history has a certain look to it. People look from the outside, they discount all of that. So you cannot get a true history of the Jewish people from the outside. You can't. So anyway, that's what I think. I think we need more people writing from the inside. Beryl Wine, people like that who are writing from the inside. And I would like to do that also. I did it here through fiction, yes, historical fiction, but I want to do destiny, which is just history.
Also more Avner Gold books. That looks good to me. But anyways, in a little seriousness, another thing I would mention is that another thing is also what you can learn from history, and also what to watch for, history repeating itself, like you mentioned, Shabbos Tzvi. And third of all...
Well, isn't it, who said that? One of the great historians said that people who don't know history are condemned to repeat it, right? Fukuyama or somebody.
Okay, so anyone that wants to, they can email me or email you, like I said, about the books if they have an opinion either way. Not that it's going to do anything, but I just have to put it out there. So what's your next, what are you working on next now, though?
What I'm working on now?
Yeah.
Tuck for Koyin of the Shach. I did the Guide to the Guide on the Meir Nevuchim. I'm working on a similar book on the Chavis Levavis. And I'm working on a book called Existence and Memory, which is about Ikri Emuna. Existence is about the existence of Ribbono Shel Olam, and memory is Torah Mesinai. How the basis of those emunas. You know, I can talk about that for a while. You don't want that now. Different time.
We'll have a different episode now. And regarding just one final thing, also regarding the Avner Gold books. So I'll put a link, but anyone can always search on Artscroll's website, Avner Gold, and local Sfarim, Judaica store. Is there a particular, you mentioned going in order, is there a particular order you would recommend? Someone's getting wants to get into the series or reread them or read the expanded editions?
They should do it in order. I should tell you what the order is?
No. The people can check out what the order is. Did you have a particular one that was your favorite, the one that was the most popular? Two questions.
My favorite, Merano Prince. I think it was the purest novel. Just as far as a pure novel. And it had, I don't want to do a spoiler, but it did not have a happy ending in the conventional sense. But it had the right ending. And I like that.
Was that also the most popular one?
Well, how would I know? You mean as far as sales go?
Either sales or feedback, but I don't know if that's hard to judge.
It's very popular. Schools use it in the classroom a lot. They use the Merano Prince. They study it. There's a study guide to the Merano Prince, made for classrooms, by Yitzchak Kaznet, and I don't know if they study the other books, But this they study.
Well, so was that one your most enjoyable one to research and to write, or was that a different one?
No, I think that was the one. I really liked it. It was like completely new to me, Muranos. It was like I did so much research. I know Spain. I could tell you, you know, where all the cities are and where they, you know, there's a book that I saw, like a history book that I'm not going to say which one, but geared more to younger children, that has like a map of Spain in the 1200s. And it has Girona and Avila and it has Madrid, right? Madrid. Hey, Madrid was built in 1550 by Philip II, you know, and Madrid, you know, are people thinking, making a map of Spain, Madrid, you know. No, but I knew, like, I knew what the rivers and the type of terrain and different areas, you know, and all the different states and, you know, I just did a lot of research. I also wrote in the back of Muranos Prince, I have a long historical essay. So I did a lot of research on that. You know, Asturias, you know, the Reconquista, when the, you know, the Muslims conquered Spain, and it was at war for 800 years. And there was a lot there that was just like very new to me.
Yeah, I'll throw out there as I'm finishing the Shapsay Sea series. It has entered my mind that I don't know if I'll do it, enough guests or anything, to do a series on Inquisition, Spanish and Spanish Portuguese and Muranos or Conversos. I think it would be interesting, but that's just a thought. It's not something that I've actually worked on yet, but if listeners are interested, they can email me if they think it's a good idea. But also, I want to mention something else that I don't know. I'm going to ask you. I don't know if they're available. There are some audiobooks now on these. I know that.
Yeah, they're available.
I know that you gave me some, and I was listening to them and enjoying them. Are they're available for purchase individually or not?
There are six so far. Yeah, they are. They should be in the stores. You can go on a website called A Magid's Market. They're produced by Aaron Kunda, Shmuel Kunda's son, and I know he's trying to develop that market. He's doing a whole series, many books, but on this series, he has the first six. The seventh is almost finished. So yeah, they're very good.
But just so again, it's an audio book, so it's not.
I tried. You see this mic? This is a very good mic. And why do I have such a mic? You know, you didn't bring it. I bring it. Your listeners can't see it, but it's a Chashev mic. So when he decided to do the audio books. So I said to him that I would like to do the reading because I know exactly how I want it read. And if somebody else is going to read it, you know, I didn't think it would be exactly the way I wanted. So he said, okay. So he got me this mic and I started doing it. And I realized that I don't have the talent for it, you know. So he told me I can keep the mic. Okay, so I have it here. I use it for my Chumash, on the Chumash video. So I'm doing a podcast also, so which you told us how to do it. So this mic is better for the podcast than what we do for the Chumash video instead of pulling it off the video. So, okay, so he let me keep this. But, you just can't do everything. It's like an acting skill. To be able to do, to read a book. And I didn't want it read. It's not dramatized. It's not with sound effects and it's just read. But just to read it is a big skill. And I didn't have it. So I gave up. I didn't get too far.
Okay, I'll try to find the link. If I find the link, I'll try to put it in the show's notes that people can find where to purchase them if they want to find the audiobooks.
It's called amagidsmarket.com. And you could see there are many books there if people want audio books. I think he's done like maybe 50 books so far.
Okay.
You know, he's trying. He should have a lot of atzlocha.
All right. Well, thanks for joining me on the podcast.
It was my pleasure. Really was.
Okay. Mr. Shem, we'll look forward. We'll try to get more episodes on other other Sfarim and books that you've written. And if listener, and again, once again, I'm going to reiterate it one last time. If anyone wants to email me or email you about the books that Avner Gold, please do.
Nachi, you are relentless.
Thank you.
But I am stubborn.
Okay, we'll see who wins. Thank you very much for joining me.
You're welcome. Be well.